Hello and welcome to Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Daphne Karnizis, standing in for Josh Fennett. On today's show...
He was the one who put dresses in museums. He made us look at them and think about them and think about what they are more than just, you know, putting them on.
We sit down with the author of a new biography about Charles James, the man dubbed America's first couturier. And...
It set out to design a suit that would be practical enough to wear no matter what the profession.
We find out how a Japanese company is reinventing workwear for blue-collar workers. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Legends of the fashion scene are rarely remembered for their agreeability. In a cutthroat industry where fragile egos are often the currency of the day, a supreme sewer's hand often comes packaged with its very own set of eccentricities. The name Charles James may not ring immediately familiar in the way that, say, Christian Dior or Yves Saint Laurent does, but as the man behind one of the great fashion houses of the 20th century, he's undoubtedly one of the field's most influential talents. His notoriously difficult persona even served as the basis of the recent film Phantom Thread, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. In a new biography, Charles James, Portrait of an Unreasonable Man, Michelle Gerber-Klein sets out to unpick this mysterious talent. Monocle's Ben Ryland sat down with the author a little earlier.
You can sew almost anything into the canvas of a coat. When I was a boy, I started to hide things in the linings of the garments. Things that only I knew were there. Secrets.
Charles James was a genius. He thought so, and his peers thought so as well. He dressed most of the famous women of his time, including Anne, Countess of Ross, Elizabeth Arden, Millicent Rogers, Dominique de Manille. He also dressed Coco Chanel and Elsa Schiaparelli, who paid him the ultimate compliment of ordering his clothes. He made Schiaparelli pay for hers and gave Coco Chanel hers for free. So perhaps Chanel is the alpha client, but Schiaparelli was his collaborator. And he was incredibly influential, not only in fashion of his time, but in the art world of his time, because he worked in close collaboration with the artists of the 30s and 40s and, to a degree, 50s as well. 60s, he was very influential to Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol started being an artist and stopped being an illustrator in reaction to a Modest ad that Charles James designed.
Looking through the pages of your book, it's not hard to get a sense of this man as someone who was immensely talented, immensely intense, dedicated so to such an extent to his craft, and yet he also carried a reputation for being a bit difficult. And that... I mean, that took him into various different areas of trouble throughout his life. But as you say, people kept coming back to him. He kept maintaining this enormous catalogue of such well-known prestigious identities who were always crawling over each other to get to his works. Why was that?
Well, he was wildly talented and enormously charismatic. He was difficult in any number of ways, and part of the reputation is exaggerated. He had a wild sense of humor. So if he didn't like something, he'd play practical jokes. So if he didn't want to pay the rent, you know, he'd go take a bag of cockroaches and dump it on the desk of the hotel where he was staying. He thought it was funny, too. He didn't suffer fools gladly, and he was very sensitive of and protective of the things he had invented. He was born in England in 1906. His mother was from Chicago. She was incredibly rich. His father was from a very famous military family in England. His grandfather had tutored Winston Churchill and made sure that Churchill got into Sandhurst. And his father had followed in his grandfather's footsteps. So they were quite proud of who they were. And Charles was born in Camberley, where they had the biggest house in town. So he was rich and, to a degree, aristocratic. And he never stopped being that. He went to Harrow. He never lost his friendships that he made there. And he had that attitude in life. And when he got to America, of course, it was all very different. He had beautiful manners and he behaved dreadfully, and they thought it was wonderful and awful at the same time. They didn't know what to make of it.
it sort of sounds as though he was cultivating that as part of his reputation as well. And we know that certainly in the world of high fashion, having some degree of distant, unattainable reputation can actually help your image, can't it?
His eccentricities served him well, and in the end, they turned against him. Toward the end of his life, Kenny Lane told me that Charles James used to show up for interviews with manufacturers with his litigation papers in a portfolio and hand it to them. So, I mean, I don't think that helped him out a lot. I don't really think he cared. The key to understanding Charles James is he really was an artist who was making clothes, not a dress designer who was trying to start a business. So he cared very much about being remembered in museums and not very much about starting a business like Dior that would continue.
His name isn't incredibly well known today, and yet his influence does carry through into today's fashion. Can you illustrate a little bit of how we might actually recognize some of what he brought?
So the wrap dress, he made the first wrap dress, he invented it. He invented it because when he first came to New York, he was in a taxi and he had this fantasy of making a dress that you could take off fast in a taxi and put back on quickly. So he made that, and obviously Diane von Furstenberg picked up on it. He made the first sports bra for a woman called Mary Ellen Hecht, who was Gertrude Stein's niece. He made fake fur before anybody else did. He made a blouse. He invented see-through blouses. But he made a blouse for Mary Hutchinson, who was Clive Bell's mistress and Virginia Woolf's friend. And it was see-through blouse. And Matisse went to sketch her, and he looked through all her clothes, and he said, "That blouse." And he finished the sketch, and he said to her, "Madame, votre blouse m'a beaucoup aidé." "Your blouse helped me a lot." So he worried very much, I think, that people would not understand him and that the beautiful things he discovered would not have an audience. I think that's what artists care about. They're very generous in one way and they're totally selfish in another. He was the one who put dresses in museums. He made us look at them and think about them and think about what they are more than just, you know, putting them on.
That was author Michelle Gerber-Klein speaking to Monocle's Ben Rylan. Still to come, we find out why Japan's blue-collar workers are getting suited and booted.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well-stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
And now to Japan, where a company has set out to help improve the image of blue-collar workers by designing workwear that looks just like a business suit. Oasis Stylewear, based in Tokyo, offers a range of lightweight, quick-to-dry business suits for men and women who work outdoors. One rice farmer became an online sensation after purchasing a suit and was dubbed the world's best-dressed farmer. Monocle's Kenji Hall reports.
The stereotypical worker in Japan, the symbolic heart of the workforce, is the dark-suited salaryman. But there are millions of cleaning staff, plumbers, rubbish collectors, and farmers for whom a suit is just not part of the daily routine. One company in Tokyo, Oasis, thought the workforce in these sectors deserved a sartorial upgrade. So it set out to design a suit that would be practical enough to wear no matter what the profession. It would look like a suit, the slacks, the collared button-down shirt, the jacket, but one that would be water-resistant, stretchy, and comfortable to wear, and come with plenty of pockets. And it had to be machine washable. The person wearing the suit would be doing physical labor and sweating under a sink, in a rice field, on a rubbish truck, but should not end up looking too rumpled. Even better if he could wear it on a date after work. This is how Oasis came up with the workwear suit. It did so to solve a problem. You see, Japan's population of young people is declining, and it's getting harder for companies in blue-collar industries to find new employees. One of Oasis's business areas is repairing water pipes in homes and apartments. And it's not glamorous work. Oasis executives thought that having employees wear a suit would make the sector seem somehow more respectable, more attractive to young people. So the company assigned a 3-woman team to come up with a solution. And in March, Oasis employees started wearing a navy-colored workwear suit. These employees were used to wearing a stiff cotton twill shirt with large pockets and snap buttons and loose-fitting pleated cotton trousers.
実は導入した初期はですね、
When we first introduced the workwear suit, some employees were opposed to wearing it.
ありまして、
That's Arisa Nakamura, head of Oasis Stylewear, the division in charge of developing the workwear suit.
これまでの作業着だと、やはり実際着ている人にとっては非常に楽なんですね。
The uniform they wore before was easier. They didn't have to think much about the appearance of their hair. Messiness wasn't a concern for them. The suit forced them to be more conscious of how they conducted themselves, their appearance. Those opposed to the suit felt it was too buttoned up, and the resistance continued for a month. But after a couple of months of getting used to it and seeing the surprised, positive reactions from customers, most of our employees didn't want to go back to the old uniform.
もう元の作業着には戻したくないという声が大半を占めています。
Wearing a suit has made employees more self-conscious. They try harder to look good. According to Nakamura, it's improved the quality of the company's service and raised the profile of the brand. In the past, employees might have let their hair grow long or unruly. Now everyone shows up clean cut, and some have even started wearing cologne. There have been other benefits for the company. The number of applications from first-time job seekers has tripled, and companies around the country have placed orders for the workwear suit, which costs around 230 euros, for their own employees. The inquiries have even poured in from overseas, from China, Taiwan, South Korea, and Spain. There's been so much interest in the workwear suit that Oasis can't keep up with demand. It's now likely to exceed its first year sales target of 100 million Japanese yen, about 770,000 euros. The company is already at work on 3 new colors in slightly different shapes and silhouettes, which will be out in the fall. It's also making progress on work shoes, caps, and gloves. So that once sharp dividing line between white collar and blue collar workers, that's blurring. And all because this company thought that its industry could use an image boost. For Monocle in Tokyo, I'm Kenji Hall.
Thanks to Monocle's Kenji Hall in Tokyo. Whether it's the vast quantities of water needed to grow cotton or the decimation of tropical birds to adorn ladies' hats, our search for style has historically brought about more than its fair share of ecological damage. Dwindling natural resources, endangered species, and polluted ecosystems. So, can high-end fashion and sustainability ever go hand in hand? A new exhibition titled Fashion from Nature at London's Victoria and Albert Museum explores the bittersweet relationship between the two from the 17th century to today. It considers how design can offer elegant solutions, moving beyond clichés of hippies in hemp. Monocle's Stephanie Sikia spoke to the curator Edwina Ehrman to learn more.
So we're standing here at the entrance to Fashion from Nature, and the opening panel explains that the exhibition explores a complicated, quite bittersweet relationship between fashion and nature, because as you can see in the cases around us at the moment, fashion is inspired by nature. It gains great creativity from it. But as the cases also show, it depends on nature for all its raw materials. And what the exhibition tries to show is that as the industry has grown in scale And I'm going to be taking you on a journey through the exhibition so that impact has riven both on the environment and on species. We're greeted at the top of the stairs by a mannequin wearing a very well-known dress, which was made by Calvin Klein for Emma Watson to wear at the Met Gala in 2016. And it is designed to be entirely sustainable to meet EcoAge principles. EcoAge is an organisation set up by Olivia Firth, which is determined to show that sustainability and high fashion are absolutely compatible. And I think for consumers, we should not look down on recycled fabrics. You know, Emma Watson's dress is made from recycled plastic bottles. Lots of the fabrics here are made from recycled materials. They are useful and good. And our ancestors actually saw waste in the same light. The V&A had a waste product collection, which sadly has now gone, to show what you could do with waste. It's a valuable commodity, and we should be using less virgin material and more recycled material. We've got interesting things like Kibiso silk, which is an outfit made by Nuno in Japan, who are a fantastically innovative textile house who work with manufacturers on innovation. And they are using the outer gummy fibres of the silk cocoon, which are normally just chucked. In traditional, very, very traditional Japanese homes, it was used because people didn't waste things. But it's always been said to be, you know, impossible to use. What they did was they looked at existing machinery and modified existing machinery. And now they can spin it, and you can see a great hunk of it on the floor over there, magnificent hunk of Kibiso silk. And then you can see it spun and woven into a very beautiful coat and dress outfit.
Briefly, could you just tell me a bit about those pre-consumer waste solutions that you mentioned earlier?
Quite a lot of designers work with what's called dead stock. So material that ends of lines of materials that's no longer useful to manufacturers, or there's no longer a market for that particular colour or that particular type of yarn at the moment because fashion is so trend-led. And designers like Katie Jones, and you see a very vibrant outfit in front of her, she's really made a specialism in using discarded materials by manufacturers. And so the jacket, which is a very colourful jacket, is made from leather offcuts that would otherwise probably end up in landfill. It would slowly degrade, but take a long time. And then the crochet trousers are made from yarn that she sourced in the same way. Everything you can see on the other side of the space from where we're standing is forward-facing. It looks at solutions. It looks at what designers and fashion houses are doing today, and, you know, tackling the problems we've created for ourselves in a range of different ways. So everything from using pre-consumer and post-consumer waste to developing new materials from waste products of the food industry, committing to produce using alternative forms of energy by certain dates, to supporting cotton initiatives, which will improve the way we grow cotton. And most excitingly, I think, from my point of view, we have four cases which show prototypes. So none of the things in these cases are fully in commercial production yet, and they're really exciting. So a couple of them look at biofabrication. The biotech innovators Bolt Threads in San Francisco, who've developed a microsilk, which was it was created to reproduce the quality of a spider silk, which is extremely strong. We have a bag made from mycelium leather, which is prototype one, that's what it's called, which is fabulous. I love prototype one. And these are designed by Stella McCartney, who is now in partnership with Bolt Threads. And alongside it, we have a dress, which is the first ever garment to be made from fabric dyed with a new process, a biotech process developed by Colorifics, who are scientists based in Cambridge and at the university in Cambridge. And it's incredibly exciting. It uses much less water, it dramatically reduces waste, and if it can be taken to commercial production and be made applicable to all the many types of fibre we have available today, it really could transform how we dye our clothes in the future. And there are others around the side which we might look at. But I really want people to come to this exhibition, you know, thinking more about fabric, thinking more about the impact our clothes have, but also enjoying their creativity. enjoying the way they celebrate nature in this rather paradoxical way. But if we're going to celebrate nature, let's protect it too. Let's treat nature as a partner, not something that's just something there for us to use. And I want people to go away feeling excited like I do about the future. There are massive challenges ahead. There's no easy answer. But now we've got government, scientists, designers, fashion houses, consumers, I hope, coming together saying, we want solutions, let's work towards that. And there's a lot more sharing and collaboration between companies than I think I've ever come across before in my career.
Do you feel that we've reached a bit of a tipping point, certainly in the high fashion industry now, where I think, you know, we think of sustainable fashion as being hippies wearing hemp, when, of course, now, as you said, we've got Stella McCartney working to make synthetic spider silk inspired fibres, etc. Do you see that as something new, that we see high fashion brands moving towards sustainable solutions?
Well, what we've tried to do in the exhibition, particularly the early origins of what we used to call eco-fashion, clean, green eco-fashion. And I've got quite a few designers from the 1990s onwards, some who I think work in a very sustainable way, like Margaret Howell, who never calls herself a sustainable designer, others who were much more overtly embrace sustainability. And we've got two good examples in front of us. One is an outfit by Helen Story, and it's a very simple, everyday outfit. It's actually not high fashion. But what's really interesting about it is a pair of trousers made from tencel and just a simple grey sweatshirt top. And the trousers are incredibly important, and we're lucky to have them in our collection because they are the first commercial manifestation of tencel, which is a viscose rayon, but made in a closed-loop safe cycle. So with minimum waste, no toxins. So that's a massive step forward. This tencel was made by Courtauld, it's now made by another company, and it is very, very important, and it set a really good example for the future of closed-loop manufacturing and circular economy. And alongside it is a fantastic outfit, which I love, which is street style. Again, it wasn't cheap, but it was more affordable than some of the fashions we've got here, designed by one of the great pioneers, Farah Ratti. And Farah said that she wanted to make fashion, good fashion that people wanted to wear, that they loved wearing, they felt good in, but it also had to be ethical. And the Farah Ratti mannequin is pointing forward to our protest island, where we have our activists and we have our environment. We have posters and slogan t-shirts and some outfits created by activists like Catherine Hamnett, Vivian Westwood. Fashion Revolution finds its place there, Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, very important. And then that swings us round. And yes, the designers we have in the final section are high fashion designers. What I want is for sustainability not to be a luxury. Yes, most of what I'm showing are luxuries, but I want sustainability to be embedded in fashion. It must be the norm. We need to get away from this idea that it's special. It has to be normal, everyday, absolutely at the core of the way we design clothes.
That was Edwina Ehrman, curator of the V&A's Fashioned from Nature exhibition, which is on until January 2019. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today, but coming up next week...
But I remember in that moment being so incredibly struck by the beauty and the intricacy and the optimism that work contained.
We visit an exhibition at New York's MoMA showcasing the extreme maquettes of Boris Isaac Kingeles, from his utopian cityscapes to fictional metropolises. Monocle on Design was edited by Christy Evans. I'm Daphne Carnesis, standing in for Josh Fennett. And we'll leave you with a track now. This is Sueno en Paraguay by Argentine singer Pedro Canal. Goodbye. Thank you.